listeners. You're listening to another episode of Beckett's Babies, a playwriting podcast. Every week, we discuss plays we love, interview theater artists, and share our thoughts on playwriting and theater. We are your hosts, Sarah Cho.
And Sam Collier. And today, we are discussing what makes a good monologue. And we're going to talk about this with a very special returning guest, Philadelphia-based dramaturg, producer, and arts education advocate, Sean Lesher. I just learned this like a minute ago. He reads one or two plays a day and has recommended 752 plays on New Play Exchange, which is just mind-boggling to me. Amazing accomplishment. Sean, welcome to Beckett's Babies. Welcome back.
Yay. Thank you for having me back. This is honestly one of my favorite podcasts. So I'm happy to just be here to talk to y'all. And I'm so glad that
You're one of our favorite
friends.
Listeners.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's so nice when your favorite podcast hosts become friends.
So topic of monologues. We mentioned, I think on previous shows, of just about was it writing a monologue?
Mm-hmm.
But I think this episode is really about, you know, what makes a monologue good and like how do people choose monologues, help people choose monologues. So Sean, so curious to know just your initial thoughts about monologues.
Okay. My initial thoughts on monologues, and I honestly want to know a lot about what y'all think too, because you're the ones that write these monologues. But as a dramaturg, I'm a big fan of the monologue. I think those are just great opportunities to remind us that what we're watching is theater. I think we see a lot of, especially like in the times we are in now, we do tend to like get a lot of plays that are like rapid fire dialogue. And so I get excited when I'm reading a play and I see like one character speaking for 3 to 4 pages. That excites me. Or when I watch it on stage too, it reminds me that like, okay, this is not happening in film and TV. This is really something that we can only really see on the stage. I don't know about you, but I'm also a fan of like plays that are basically monologues. Do you enjoy those sometimes too?
Like, what would be an example?
Yeah.
Oh my gosh. Like, one of my favorites is Brian Friel. He's an Irish playwright who wrote the play. Well, the ones I'm thinking of right now are Faith Healer and, Molly Sweeney, which are basically, each play is like three characters and they're talking about one event through each character's perspective, pretty much.
Oh, cool.
So it's basically like, I saw Faith Healer on Broadway with Ralph Fiennes and Cherry Jones and Ian McDiarmid. So three fantastic actors. So it's just, I just enjoy that you're sitting in the audience and you're just watching basically someone tell you a story. I'm trying to think of another one that I've read. I've actually been really, you had Brian James Polak on your show a few weeks ago, right? And Brian hosts a podcast called The Subtext. Have you listened to that podcast before?
Yeah, it's great. Mm-hmm.
I love that podcast. And his last guest was the actor playwright Wallace Shawn, which a lot of people know as, Princess Bride. And he's the voice of Rex in the Toy Story series or My Dinner with Andre. But he's also a fantastic playwright.
I didn't know he was the voice of Rex.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. Wow. And when you like listen to that, watch that movie, you're just like, yeah, that's that voice. But he's also a playwright, and I've been reading his plays recently, and he has two in particular called The Designated Mourner and The Fever, which are just basically, The Fever is basically just a one-person show. Designated Mourner is three actors, but there's like pages and pages of one person talking. I like those a lot. But like I said, I think the monologue just reminds us what makes theater special and what is it, I don't know, that magic of everyone leaning in to watch one person tell a story or one person talk.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I love that you brought up like solo performance, solo artist, as like a good example. Like that's monologuing for sure.
with your background in comedy, Sarah, I think I'm very interested in that, like what makes it stand-up comedy and what makes it like a solo one-person show kind of thing. I haven't seen the new Bo Burnham special yet, but I love Mike Birbiglia's stuff, and I think like he brings on a director to like a theater director to do all his stuff, and I think it shows. It's really not just your traditional, oh, this is a stand-up comedy set. No, it's a monologue.
Right. Yeah. And Mike Birbiglia for sure is like, I never saw him as like a stand-up comedian, because I saw him in more of like a storyteller. Because stand-up comedians is like, there might be a story threaded through, but it's mainly like jokes. It's like a lot of jokes, right. and observations. For me personally, like, I honestly don't, like, purposely write monologues. I don't go and, like, proactively write a monologue. It's like I almost use it as a filler sometimes, which is so bad to say. It's like, I don't know what's going on. Like, I need something to connect these two things. Mm. And oftentimes monologues, I use it as a device to just – is it, 'cause they're always, like, two types of monologues I've noticed is, like, right – recollecting, telling a story, you know, but otherwise it's like very presentational, you know, there's like, hey, this is me and this is what I'm going to talk about, you know, I don't know.
But what do you think about the monologues that take place in real time, like within the world of the play, where like it's just talking back and forth, and then all of a sudden somebody just decides to talk for a few pages?
Right. Yeah. Well, like, and I think oftentimes in that moment, is like they're either recollecting or right. like, because like, you did this to me. Do you remember that? Right. You blah, 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 blah. You did this to me and you married my brother. You know, I don't know. It's obviously like they're pointing on recollecting. It's never really, almost always, it's never as very like active present tense, unless they're like actually attacking that person and saying something to them directly.
Well, because you have to have some kind of reason that the other person is not talking for an extended period of time. That's what I find so fascinating about monologues like that, is like there has to be some good reason that the other person decides to just listen. And that can make it really exciting.
And I think it'd also be a character thing. It says something about the character. Like I'm thinking particularly of, oh my gosh, the scene in Angels in America where Lewis and Belize are just talking and Lewis just goes on and on and on. And it's just like, yeah, we know in that moment that Lewis just likes to hear himself talk. And Belize is just, right. And the thing about that scene too is Belize is, he's not passive. He's sitting there, he's rolling his eyes and he's waiting to be like, yeah, this white guy is wrong.
Okay, so Sean, one of the things that you do that I think is so cool is you help people find monologues, right?
I do, yes.
Using your extensive knowledge of plays and like, can you just tell us a little bit about what that process looks like and how you help people find something?
Yeah, sure. So I found that people were coming to me a lot just because my reputation as knowing a lot of new work was kind of getting out there a little bit. And people would just come up to me and say, like, hey, I'm really interested in getting to know new stuff. What do you recommend? So I would, I hate that idea of like the blanket recommending of like, oh, what do you think I should read? Because like my tastes are very different than Sam's tastes and Sarah's tastes. We all like different things. So I really want to know, okay, I read so many different things. So like, if you told me, like, you know what, I'm interested in, I mean, we were talking a little bit off mic about ghost plays. So if Sam or Sarah said, oh, I like ghost plays, then I would rat off a bunch of things to you. And this was during the pandemic and I was unemployed. And I'm just like, you know, and I was going through coaching at the time, and coaching was really a life coaching, career coaching, that kind of thing. And it was really, I was working with my coach on really pushing myself out there and just trying to figure out what my life would look like not going back to being someone else's employee kind of thing. How can I make theater what I earn my living from. So I decided to, I built my website, or my friend built my website for me. Shout out to Bryn Frauenhofer, who's a really good playwright in Chicago and also a really great website designer. And I decided to start this monologue service where basically I will have a 30-minute phone call with an actor, and I'll ask them a series of questions that range from, what kind of theater excites them? What's their type? What do you wish people who type you would see? What kind of work they're interested in? I really try and curate it to not, and I try and make it clear to my clients too that if you're looking for just the same stuff that you've been typed as, I'm probably not the person to go to. I'm much more interested in finding clients' work that either pushes them outside of their type or kind of subverts the type a little bit. I really just want to get people excited about music. So we'll have that 30-minute call, and depending on which package they get, I either find them three or five monologues from new plays on New Play Exchange, and I will recommend cuts or like which paid numbers to look at and everything. And yeah, so that's it's been slow a little bit recently, but I think I'm hoping that now that auditions are actually happening again, things will pick up over the summer. But yeah, so that's what I've been doing, and it's been a lot of fun.
That is super cool. And I think, you know, one of the things I didn't realize when I was younger and back when I was actually auditioning as an actor for things, it took me a long time to realize that you can take, as you know, as an actor looking at a play, if there's a monologue you like, but it's only, I don't know, five sentences and you need something that's seven sentences, you can actually just like find two more sentences like later down the page that maybe aren't necessarily part of that monologue. You can just add it, or, you know, you can edit things and adapt them to what you need.
Right. But it also, what I'm realizing that it also depends, because I'm working right now also with my younger sister who is working on the college auditions. She's going to be a senior in high school. She goes to a performing arts high school. So I'm working on helping her find stuff. And I'm working with one of her fellow students too. And I'm realizing some of them do require that they be one big chunk. There's a lot of like weird stuff, especially in the college audition world. There's also like, I'm finding a lot of them also say like it needs to be from published plays. So I'm like, and I'm curious if that just means that they don't know what New Play Exchange is. Because if you're only sticking to like, well, it has to be published plays, like, I don't know, it's leaving a lot out. And also like we all know how racist and exclusionary the publishing world is in general, but especially like you only get your plays published if they're produced, and it's still a majority of white playwrights getting produced, so that's who's getting published.
I wonder why they would have that rule.
I honestly just think it was created, from what I understand from people I've talked to, it was created as not letting the students write their own monologues for themselves to audition with, which I also don't understand why that's an issue. Like, wouldn't that be a cool thing?
Yeah.
And it's just something they've never re-looked at. And I also think part of it is they just don't know what New Play Exchange is.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, if you want somebody to show this, to demonstrate the skill that they can find a text written by someone else and find something of themselves inside that text, then I can understand why you wouldn't want them to write it themselves. But I agree.
Yeah, I get that.
That seems like such a small portion of unpublished plays. Literally. Like,
and I'm also curious too, if it's like, do these adjudicators just want students to pick work that they've heard of so they can then judge if they're doing it right or something like that?
Right. That's probably more of what it is.
Yeah. But no, I've been loving coaching the students, but monologue recommending has been a blast. I actually have recommended one of your plays, Sarah. I recommended a monologue from Kung Flu.
Oh, really? Awesome.
Yeah.
I was like, wait, there's a monologue in there?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure there is.
Thanks, John. Of course. So there are monologues that exist in a play, mm-hmm. and then there are monologues that I've seen, like, standalone. Like, writers just writing them. Like writers just writing the monologues.
Or not even a show, but just, like, for an exercise. Like, somebody might just write...
Oh, yes.
Right,
yes.
But, okay. Or even just like people might write like a 5-minute monologue.
Yeah.
And there's actually a lot of writers that do just that on New Play Exchange. Like I think of Asher Wyndham, who basically only writes monologues. And like a lot of the plays are labeled like monologue for a teenage girl kind of thing. So yeah, I think there's definitely a market for that. I kind of wanted to ask real quick too, Sam, when you were talking about, and you too, Sarah, like, did you ever, like, before New Play Exchange was a thing or before you knew about finding stuff, did you go to those great monologues for blanks in the bookstores or whatever?
I did, but I never found anything I liked.
Yeah.
I mean, especially because, really? Like, you know, when I was doing this, I would be like, I don't know, 19. I would look at a book that was like, monologues for young women.
Women,
it was just like they were all just trash.
Yeah,
and also, I was like, I don't want to play any of these characters.
And like, I would pick a like, you know, in college for like an acting class. I'm like, oh, I have to find a monologue, and I would just like that was like easy go to, right? Mm-hmm. And I would pick a monologue from those books and bring it to class, and my teacher would just like, no. They're like,
really?
It's like they'll just say no. And then it's like those monologues from those books like have a smell to them or something. Because it's like all my acting teachers were like, please don't like read a play, find a monologue from a play. You know, they like want me to do that.
Mm-hmm. Well, because then it feels like it has more substance and context to it, especially for a young actor. Like it helps you to know what the whole story is.
Right,
but it's also it's tough, especially when you're a student.
Yeah, it is tough. And one of my favorite things I ever saw was when I was in college, I was like waiting to audition for the first year show, and there was a kid there who had to audition because he was in acting one and they were all required to audition, like even if they didn't want to be in the play. And he was auditioning with the Sermon on the Mount from the Bible. He was playing the role of Jesus.
Oh my gosh.
And he was just doing that because like he had to audition. And I was like, that is brilliant.
Wait, like, was it for like Godspell or Jesus Christ Superstar at least?
No. Literally the show is just like a collection of short plays. But he I don't know. He was like, why am I having to audition when I don't want to be in the play? I'm just going to pick the Sermon on the Mount. But I really like it when people pick kind of unusual texts to use as a monologue. I always think that shows something really interesting.
A friend of mine just
a nice change. I mean, having sat through like hours and hours and hours of auditions where people bring in monologues, I have to say, like, so many of the same ones are repeated. Like I never need to see another Neil LaBute monologue as long as I live. And so anytime somebody brings in something new or different, it's really refreshing.
Yeah, I feel like Neil LaBute and like a lot of David Mamet, like I don't know, I just think of that, I think of Barry, and how didn't like Barry like do like Alec Baldwin's monologue from Glengarry Glen Ross or something
like
in a
movie.
Class or something? Yeah.
Oh,
so
yeah,
like,
yeah.
But a friend of mine actually to go with what you were saying, Sam, about like other kind of text. A friend of mine just got into an MFA program over in London, and the requirement was to use a classical text and then a modern text, and it could be. From a play or it could be a speech or anything. So she ended up doing a Shakespeare piece for the classical. And then she did like a Betty Friedan speech for her contemporary piece.
Cool.
And it was like, it was, I'm like, that's so, so cool. But don't, luckily today, things are getting better with those monologue books. I mean, I still recommend once you find the monologue that you like, you read the full play. But I know it's just hard to like kind of sit through a play and sift through it. But I am glad that there's like the Kilroys just came out with two volumes of monologues from plays on those lists. And there is a WordPress site called nonbinarymonologues.wordpress.com. And it's a collection of monologues just for non-binary actors.
That's awesome.
So, but like I said, I just recommend once you find the one you like, make sure you read the play.
Well, and the internet is amazing because I also just remember spending hours in the stacks of the library, like reading play after play, trying. And when I say reading, I mean skimming, you know, for like a block of text.
That was something that I was going to bring up too. I think formatting of monologues is so important when you're writing.
Say more about that.
Yeah, it's. I mean, I'm only half joking about this, but when it comes to finding monologues in plays, I often like look through for like, okay, where's a lot of text all put together? But yeah, it's. I think it definitely tells the story. It's when if it's all if the monologue is just very much no spaces, it's just a bunch of words and everything. I mean, that either tells me that they didn't consider the formatting or like it's just a rushed monologue. There's opportunities to really use spaces, to use Jen Silverman is brilliant too, but I mean, Dance Nation, just look at Ashley's monologue on the page. It's the formatting that is just absolutely brilliant. And it just really, as an actor, your job is basically done for you. You know exactly what you need to be doing the way that Clara Barron has formatted that piece. But yeah, I think, I feel like writers just help directors out a lot by their formatting choices, because you really get to know the rhythm. Yeah,
I completely agree, but I've also heard some people say that that's like director proofing the script and like the playwright's trying to be too controlling by dictating so much through the way they put it on the page. And I'm just wondering how you would respond to that argument.
The way I would respond to that is, and it's just my opinion, and it's solely because I'm a playwright first person. I love the playwright. Theater is a playwright's medium. I'm not wild about these visionary directors. I'm not wild about. I think the director just really needs to serve the playwright's vision. So if a writer feels like they need to do something to make it safe from a director who might want to put their own vision on it, I think that's totally their thing. I mean, we look at Alfred Hitchcock, where they talk about he would film things only one way, so it could only be edited one way. And we call him a genius for it.
So we
really need to be giving the same to playwrights. And I'm sorry if that makes a director upset that they can't show off their brilliant technique and whatever. But the director's number one job should always be to serve the playwright and the playwright's vision.
Hear, hear. I like that. It's
controversial, but
I love it.
I love it. Yeah.
It's not controversial in Beckett's Babies.
And there's the Greeks and there's Shakespeare for directors to screw around with. There you go.
Yes, exactly.
Or pay a playwright really, really well and then buy the rights to their plays. You can do it with that. Playwrights don't make anything. So the least you can give them is complete control over their work.
So let's go back to when you're looking for three or five monologues for a person, once you've kind of decided with them what you want to highlight about their skill or their type, how do you choose, like, what distinguishes kind of a mediocre monologue or one that might be really important in a play, but isn't that great on its own, from a really kick-ass audition monologue? Like, what are some of the ingredients you look for?
Well, I definitely talk to the actors about what kind of tone they're going for. A lot of times, and I agree with this too, a lot of actors don't really want to, like, I mean, to make it simple, like, I've talked to a lot of actors that are just like, I don't really want to do anything that requires me to cry in an audition. I'd rather save that for the performance. Yeah, I mean, it like I said, we talk about tone. We talk about, do you want to work on more dramatic stuff, more comedic stuff? I want to give them something that really shows off their skills, and that maybe gets the people behind the table excited. Because I recommend new plays. A lot of times they're plays by my friends, because I also want these casting people to know about these playwrights. So if they're hearing a lot of Alex Lynn plays in their audition rooms, I want them to be like, oh, who's this Alex Lynn? I want to be doing Alex Lynn plays.
That's awesome.
What
would be an example of a play that, right, yeah, that like really shows off somebody's talents?
I want to show off their talent. I want them to get excited about the plays as a whole, but not have it be anything like, oh, well, it kind of feels like taking out of context or anything. Does that make sense? Like, I don't want it to be like a piece where the people behind the table are like, this doesn't make sense. I guess it would make sense if I saw the whole play. Who I think does this really well is a writer. Her name is Catherine Weingarten, who basically writes meme speak and like internet speak. So like, and she writes super, super smart women who talk, and they talk about really, really big things, but there's also rooms for the and the ands, and just really natural feeling speech and everything. I use a lot of her plays because I feel like a lot of her characters basically speak who they are through monologues. So I like that idea. Not too much like plot stuff, but just stuff that gets that kind of gets you to know who the character is, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, definitely stuff that's like more character focused, and less. And I mean, some actors have asked me like, yeah, I don't want a monologue where somebody's telling a story, which makes it harder, but it's a challenge I'm up for. I do tend to prefer like those monologues that are like basically asides. I don't want to say prefer, but I like them a lot. The ones that are kind of like, let's step out of the action and maybe not talk to the audience, but like have a out of body discussion and everything.
One of the things that makes the like telling a story monologue difficult, I think, for an audition is that you have to do a bunch of extra work to make it active, because it's not necessarily active on its own. So I wonder if when people say that, it's because they're looking for something that's like, you know, a monologue that's happening in real time with another character has all of this built-in dynamic energy, whereas a monologue that where somebody's telling a story, you know, you have to kind of supply some of that energy or find a way to make it active.
I'm a big fan of plays that are taking place in the internet, within the internet and social media world. And a lot of times I'll find playwrights will write monologues basically as posts or as like tweet threads or something like that. I think those work really well, because we're basically already doing that through TikTok and our vlogs and everything. So I enjoy plays where that's the monologue is like I said, either a very active, I'm talking to one person, but it's a one-sided conversation right now, or a, like I said, a Facebook post as a monologue kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like Katherine Weingarten does that really well. Yes, rants. I like rants.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But yeah, but for auditions, I mean, there's a beautiful monologue at the end of Heroes of the Fourth Turning, but I would never give that to an actor to audition with because it just requires a lot of screaming and crying. And I feel like we're past that.
Mm.
I feel like hopefully we're moving away from that where we're telling actors that they have to leave everything in the audition room. No.
Mm.
Please don't.
I hope we're past that, but I feel like
yeah,
we're not.
I know, it's hard.
It just made me think about one of my first monologues I had to perform just in a class, an acting class, and it was just I was picked the monologues that were the crazy woman. You know what I mean?
Right.
Screaming and stop it.
But also,
I don't know why.
When you bring that to the audition room and if you get the part, they expect that same energy all the time. I'd rather know that I could work with an actor. I'd rather just kind of get an idea. I don't want to be you just ramped it up to 11. So is there anywhere we can go with that?
Mm. What about, do you ever give people suggestions of monologues that are really different from like maybe the part is written for an actor who's a different gender or different age or something, but you feel like this monologue would really, that this, I don't know, actor would do a really good job of that. Do you ever recommend anything like that? I know a lot of women who will audition with Shakespeare monologues written for men, just because a lot of times they have better monologues.
Right. I haven't yet. And that's mainly because I mostly work on new contemporary texts. And I feel like we can play around with that a lot more with the classic stuff. That's the part of me that's kind of I do want to give them something that they could play. So if I am working with, if I'm working with a non-binary client, I'll very specifically say if they don't want to, they'll tell me I either want non-binary, but I'll also do male presenting or female presenting. And yeah, I very much let them decide that.
Awesome. Yeah, that's cool.
All right. So I guess before we move on to Glistens, I'm trying to think of a question that's similar to what advice would you give? But I don't want to do that question. But I guess it's what?
No, because if I give advice, then they won't come to me.
Okay. Maybe it's a two-part then. What advice? Finding that great monologue for young actors or any actors in general. But two is in your experience of reading all these plays and of finding these monologues, what is the thing that comes to your mind of in one sentence or two, but what makes the monologue really stand out and
memorable
and it sticks with you? Why pick certain monologues over others, you know?
Yeah, I'm going to start with that second question first.
Okay.
It's either I've seen it on stage or it's the memory I have, either from seeing it performed or reading it for the first time, where after I read or see that monologue, you just have that gut feeling of, wow, I just saw or read something really, really special. You can't always put your finger on it. But and maybe it kind of takes you out of the magic of the play a little bit, but it's almost like you sit back and just be like, okay, playwright, you just made some magic with those words. So yeah, it's that admiration for the craft, but also that unexplained. I can't really explain it. It's just, yeah, especially when I read it.
It sounds like you're saying you know it when you see it.
Yeah, you know it when you see it, and you just it kind of it makes you have to take a break from reading because you just need to like sit and digest what that was.
Mm-hmm. I wonder if monologues is the only place where where really the playwright could really speak to the audience directly almost and like with a certain level of truth that really kind of stamps what the play is about in a way. You know, like here's what I'm really trying to say here directly to you, and I hope it means something to you.
Yeah, and I mean a lot of those plays, you think of like an Octoroon where like Brandon Jacob Jenkins has a huge monologue that's like read by a character named BJJ. So a lot of times like playwrights will be, or David Henry Hwang does that with his play Yellowface, where it's just like, hey, I'm the playwright and here's my thesis statement. But those are two brilliant playwrights that do it without making them feel like thesis statements, if that makes sense.
Definitely.
And then advice, you should hire me. I have very reasonable rates. but also, yeah, just read a lot of stuff, see a lot of things. If you see something, I mean, obviously theater is now just reopening. But yeah, I just recommend reading as much as you can. If you like a playwright's work, but they don't have a monologue that you think would fit them, how about reach out to the playwright and ask them to write you something? Of course, pay them. But it's really interesting. I've met many playwrights that are like, yeah, I want to write monologues for actors. So please commission them. And they're really good at writing in other people's voices. That's kind of what they do. But if you see something and you hear a monologue that you really like, pick up the play from your library after going to see it or something. Unless it's the Kilroy's collection of monologues, don't pick up those plays that say best monologues for teen boys or whatever. just don't. Yeah. When I talk to my actors, what I tell my clients a lot, find stuff that makes you happy. If it makes you happy, and I think it's the same with like musical theater, auditions too. They tell you to pick a song that makes you happy. Just have fun. It's a chance for you to act. If you come in looking at like that way, the piece will just be better. If this piece from King Lear you think really shows off your skills, that's great. But if it doesn't make you happy, that's going to come across in the auditions.
Great. Great advice.
Yeah, I kind of went into like
wow.
directing stuff there, but all my hats get
That's
mixed
great,
up.
That's great, though.
All right. Well, should we move on to Glistens?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. I could go first. So my Glisten is I saw, I guess, like the last showing of Someone Else's House with Geffen Playhouse. And speaking of monologues and solo shows and stuff, like this was this one person performing. It was a Zoom play and it was like him telling a story about this haunted house that his family lived in and the sort of like what they went through and how it scared everyone. It was such a compelling story, but also involved audience participation. There was visuals. There were all this like audiovisual things that was going on, props being used. Like it was like one of the most fun 70 minutes of my life on Zoom. Like I could not believe that. I was like, I'm like, I'm having fun on Zoom. Like this is insane. there's like a little haunting kit that came with the play where we lit the candle.
Oh my gosh, that's so cool.
It was like a whole experience that, I mean, as like things are reopening and like I'm hoping the Zoom plays are here to stay, but also, here's this whole other platform, like opportunity for like visual digital artists to like really take over if they want to with this. They're making it their own with theater. So that's my glisten.
Amazing. Well, okay. So my glisten is that in a few days, I'm going to be moving to Boulder, Colorado.
Oh my goodness.
I haven't announced yet on this podcast, but now is the moment, I guess. I am going to be starting a PhD in theater and performance studies at the University of Colorado. And so pretty soon I'm going to load up my car with all my stuff and my dog and drive almost all the way across the country.
Wow. Wow. Sam, you've lived all over the country.
Like, I have lived so many places. So
different time zones. I can't
wait to come to all of you every week from mountain time.
Woo! It's great for me, honestly. 1 hour apart, I love it.
Yeah, that'll be nice.
Yeah. Sean, what's your glisten?
Oh my gosh. I still don't know. So I'm going to do three glistens, but I'll do them in rapid fire. So I went to the movies for the first time since last March. I saw Zola.
Oh, wow. What did you see?
Yeah, it was fantastic. I saw it was an empty. I had the theater myself, which was lovely. But yeah, I highly recommend seeing Zola. I don't want to say anything more about it. Just go see it. It's really good. And theater related because it's co-written by the slave play playwright Jeremy O'Harris, and it's really good. Second glisten is yesterday was my dear friend Alex Lynn's birthday, who was a guest on Beckett's Babies and yes. Just one of my favorite playwrights. And she's killing it right now. She's got a play. You should go read her stuff on New Play Exchange. She's got a play called Bad Chinese Daughter, which is like being looked at by some fancy people that I can't wait to see where that play goes. She just got selected for residency with Theater Moo to work on some plays. We're gonna do a little reading of one of her plays that really excites me soon. And I think next week she's gonna be doing the 24-hour play festival series. Yeah. And then my last one is coffee shops. Very I've been cool. going back to coffee shops, and I've missed them so much. And they're just the best.
Nice.
And I'm sure Pennsylvania will probably lock down again. But until that happens, I'm gonna visit my coffee shops and be with my people again.
It's been nice seeing people like sit down, enjoying their coffee inside. I mean, I think I'm still not ready to be like. To do that just yet, but it's been really nice to see people doing that, opening their laptops, working away,
and you're just
shop.
Watching them from a distance.
Just like, and like enjoying what they're doing, and I'm like, this is nice.
And they're just like, why is this person like pushing their nose up against the window, looking at my coffee, watching me drink my latte?
Yeah, we still don't, where I live, we still don't really have any coffee shops that are doing indoor, like, dining right now. There's one place that's doing outdoor, and then the other places are still takeout, but.
Well, I started working out a couple weeks ago, which I've been enjoying.
Cool.
Oh, awesome. There's this one coffee shop in Santa Barbara that used to be, like, an auto shop. So there's, like, a garage store. And that has been converted into a coffee shop. So they opened that garage door, and it's kind of like almost like a semi-outdoorsy like coffee shop that people could enjoy their coffee and still feel like
cool.
They're not indoors, you know. It's really cool.
Do you know what's funny? Yeah. To go along with that, when I moved back to Pennsylvania a few months ago, it's kind of the opposite of what you're talking about, Sarah, but my childhood Blockbuster, I drove by it the other day and it's been turned into an auto shop, and I got really sad.
Wow.
What? Like, does the building still have like Blockbuster remnants?
No. See, like, it was one of those, no? Blockbusters. Wow. like when Blockbuster started closing, it became like a Halloween store, like so many other Blockbusters became. But then, like, eventually they're just like, yeah, it's just gonna be something else. So they opened an auto shop there, and I just got really sad.
Wow.
Well, if you ever are craving a video store fix, you can come to Belfast, Maine, which still has a fully operating video rental store.
Or Bend, Oregon, where it's the last Blockbuster.
Oh, they sell the Blockbuster.
Yeah, there's a really good documentary on. There's a really good documentary on Netflix called The Last Blockbuster, which is about the last Blockbuster in the world in Bend, Oregon.
Wow.
Oh, yeah, I heard about that one. Mm-hmm. Well, like the last. Blockbuster. Hopefully this won't be our last
episode. So, yeah, like, where is this going?
I have no idea where this is going.
Listeners, share your thoughts with us about video stores and monologues and anything else that's on your mind. We want to hear from you.
And Sean, thank you so much for coming onto our show again. Hopefully you'll come back soon again to talk about other plays and other topics. Things that excite you.
Yeah, of course. I'm very excited.
Yeah, and don't forget, if you're out there and you're looking for a monologue, check out Sean Lesher and his monologue service.
Yay.
Thank you.
Thanks for tuning in to another episode of Beckett's Babies. If you enjoyed what you heard or learned a thing or two about playwriting, be sure to like, subscribe, and share the podcast with your friends.
And if you'd like to reach out and share with us your thoughts on playwriting and theater, or maybe be a guest on the show, be sure to visit our website at www.beckettsbabies.com. That's www.beckettsbabies.com, and you can contact us there. Thanks for listening.